Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. On today's program, Ellen speaks with one of her closest confidants, her daughter, Jamie Brown Hansen, about what we can learn from nature about the future of our global economy and the principles that we should be employing for true sustainability. Jamie is helping lead an international team studying the primary lessons to be learned from natural systems that are billions of years old, and to examine the legitimacy of economies built on fabrications unrelated to natural factors and forces. Capitalism's central pursuit of constant growth, for example, is one such core feature that is unnatural and dangerous to prop up at any expense, as we are now. And speaking of propping things up, Ellen's going to be advising you of what lies ahead for anyone who has money in the bank, whether as a depositor, a city or state, or a pensioner. The global banking cartel has just inked a deal that can take it all away from you the next time their banking franchise fails. Later on in the program on the Public Banking Report, we talk with the Public Banking Institute's Executive Director, Gwen Hallsmith, about the New Economy Academy, which is launching this week and will be going into next year, providing some important baseline understandings on money, banking, and the nature of the emerging new economy. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, the G20 has rubber-stamped another ruse to prop up the big banks with our money, and this time it's our pensions that they're going after. They went after our tax money with the bailouts of 2008 and 2009, but we, or our government, balked at that. And so in the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, it basically said no more bailouts. Instead, they would be doing bail-ins, which means they would be propping up the big banks by confiscating the money of their creditors. Well, it turns out that the largest class of creditor of any bank is their depositors. So we soon figured that out, and we balked at that. So now they've come up with yet another scheme, or another, well, this is called a buffer. So it's supposedly that the big banks are to retain 16 to 20% of their risk-weighted assets in the form of equity or bonds convertible to equity in the event of bank insolvency. So that's supposed to protect the creditors because there's this big buffer of money that either already belongs to the bank or that the bank will be able to confiscate by converting it to bank capital. Well, it turns out that these convertible bonds, also called bail-in bonds or bail-inable bonds, are targeted for the pension funds. That's who's expected to buy them. These bonds will look just like the bonds that the banks usually issue, except somewhere in the fine print, it'll say that in the event that the bank becomes insolvent, these bonds will be turned to bank stock. Needless to say, bank stock is not something you can spend like you could spend your pension or your deposits. In fact, if the bank goes very insolvent, like Bear Stearns did in early 2007, I believe, or 2008, then your bank stock could essentially be worthless. A bank is considered insolvent when its liabilities exceed its assets. So the way they're fixing this problem is by the neat trick of moving things that are currently on their liability side of their balance sheet into the capital portion of their balance sheet. So it looks like an accounting trick, but what it means is they're confiscating their creditors' money. And the fact that we have this 16 to 20% buffer, even if they do take our pension fund money, doesn't necessarily mean that the deposits will not be hit. The problem is the derivatives, which currently the exposure of the five biggest U.S. banks, which hold virtually all the derivatives, is something close to $280 trillion. And our deposits are only protected by the FDIC fund, which supposedly covers $250,000 in deposits. but it only, last time I looked, contained $46 billion. And the deposits it's supposed to insure are something like $4.5 trillion. And then you have this $280 trillion derivative exposure. And under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivative counterparties go first in a bankruptcy. So that means they're considered secured creditors because they have to post collateral in order to gamble in the casino, the derivatives casino. But what they're posting as collateral is basically our deposits. Ever since the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in the late 1990s, the banks are allowed to commingle our deposits with their gambling, their investment wing. So that means basically that they can gamble with our money. So that collateral could be gone. Once the counterparty snatched the collateral, it could be gone. And then the FDIC fund is just not going to be able to get it back, particularly since the Dodd-Frank Act says that we, the people, are not going to be responsible for bailing out the banks, which one would assume that means the Treasury is not going to be responsible either. So the FDIC, which used to be able to borrow from the Treasury, may not be able to do that in the next big derivatives bust. So if we have a bail-in of the sort that you can envision, it could actually be worse than a bailout. So these bail-ins are being sold as avoiding bailouts, getting governments off the hook, and avoiding too big to fail. But actually, they do not get we the people off the hook. In fact, we the people are more on the hook than ever. If our taxes go up, we can probably still pay the rent. But if our deposit account is closed, if our deposits are taken or our pensions are taken, we could be out in the street. And all this manipulation doesn't actually prevent too big to fail either. In fact, it institutionalizes too big to fail because the banks won't fail. They will stay alive by eating our money, our deposits, and our pensions. All this fancy footwork is being done in order to prevent a massive bank run because they need our deposits. They want our deposits to back their derivatives scheme. But it might be time for us to consider an old-fashioned bank run. It might be time for us to pull our money out of the big Wall Street banks and put them in our own publicly owned banks, banks that will serve the public because they are owned by the public. These bail-in schemes are actually the handiwork of the Financial Stability Board, which is an offshoot of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. At least it's housed in the same building as the Bank for International Settlements. And it originated in the late 1990s as just an advisory board of central bankers and finance ministers who are supposed to be advising on how to keep the banks afloat. But it turned into a body that had much more power after the 2009 crisis when the G20 met in London and endorsed the Financial Stability Board, and it was now covered the 20 nations as opposed to the original Financial Stability Forum, which only was the G7. So the mandate of the Financial Stability Board is to maintain financial stability and avoid systemic risk. The problem is that the system that they're trying to protect is too small. They're protecting the banking system, but they're doing it at the expense of the rest of us, the people in the planet. So we need to enlarge the system. We need a system that protects all their stakeholders, profits, people, and planet. So my guest today has some interesting ideas on how we could do that. Since it's Thanksgiving and my daughter's here from Switzerland, I thought I would take this opportunity to interview her as she has some very interesting ideas on how to design a money system. Here's her bio for an introduction. Jamie Brown Hansen received the U.S. Presidential Scholar's Medallion from President Bill Clinton in 1999. She graduated in 2005 in the top 10% of her class from London School of Economics with a Master of Science in Development Management, where she wrote her dissertation on global money reform from a development perspective. In 2007, she took a job in Basel, Switzerland, at a nonprofit collaborating center of the United Nations Environment Program, where she designed and managed the first convening body in the international system for public finance agencies in the clean energy sector. Meanwhile, she explored the official institutional channels for building a partnership between financial policy and environmental policy at the global level, specifically between UNEP and the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, which is right there in Basel. Now she is a managing partner of Biomimicry Switzerland, where her current pursuit is understanding how nature would design a financial system. She is now working with the Global Eco-Village Network, the Biomimicry Global Network, and the Community Currency Movement to create a bio-inspired model of financial architecture. Jamie, it's great to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be on your show, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. So at our last public banking conference, which was in San Rafael, California, a year and a half ago, you were one of the speakers, but you were speaking about something different then, or your presentation had a different focus. Can you tell us about that and why you shifted gears and what you're pursuing now in the way of money reform?
Sure. I came to the topic of financial system design from a development perspective, as you mentioned. And when I took that job in Basel, the job itself had lit up my imagination because it looked to me like it was located directly between financial policy and environmental policy at the global level. So at that point, I dedicated myself to trying to build a partnership between the BIS and UNEP to get environmental considerations into the design of our financial system, environmental and sustainability considerations. And at the end of 2011, I was done exploring those official institutional channels, and I received a phone call around the same time from Hazel Henderson's, who much of your audience is familiar with. She's on your Public Banking Institute advisory board, along with myself, and she's been a visionary for many decades. She helped launch, or was instrumental in building, the sustainable investment movement. And she called me up and said, "Jamie, biomimicry is the future." I had never heard of biomimicry at that point. She described it to me as the end point of trends in sustainable investment. So I started researching and learning about biomimicry, which is the discipline of translation between natural design and human design. So trying to apply the lessons of 3.8 billion years of research and development to the design of human products and processes and systems. And what I concluded was that this is exactly what the field I'd started in, sustainable development. This is what the field has been missing, because development so far, up until today, the intellectual foundation of our approach to sustainable development has been based in human design only, in human society and human systems. And what this does is it offers us a way to go deeper by looking at ecological design and a much longer, older perspective on the evolution of complex adaptive systems, which is what the financial system is.
Well, that's a pretty interesting challenge, because finance is not actually found in nature, right? So how do you relate the two?
Nature can teach us things about making smart, efficient, sustainable, long-lasting, regenerative, elegant designs with our big human brains that don't exist in nature. So biomimicry can be applied to products, processes, or systems, irrespective of whether they exist in nature. And in the case of finance, as I mentioned, is a complex adaptive system, and the natural world is the ultimate authority on designing complex adaptive systems that survive over the long term, that are regenerative over the long term within the operating conditions of this planet. So there's a lot that we can learn about complex adaptive systems that can help us achieve the same qualities for our financial system that we admire in natural systems.
Well, we probably need to get down to some specific examples so people will know what you're talking about. When you say systems, that always makes me think of systemic risk is a big thing now in finance. Everybody's always concerned because the big banks are interconnected, and if one goes down, they all go down, and that's why governments wound up bailing out the banking system, and now what I've just been writing about is the bail-in that's following the bailouts. So their next ploy is to be taking our deposits and our pensions in order to keep their banking system afloat, which is considered sustainability. It supposedly counters systemic risk, but the system they're talking about is just the banking system. It seems to me that their system needs to be enlarged to include, as you say, the environment and the people, the other people. So how would you relate that to biomimicry?
I would agree with you that the mandate of the financial system is too narrow. Right now it's defined only very narrowly and in financial terms to deal with risk management and financial stability. And one thing we can learn from nature is that there is no system that exists separated from other systems. Every single natural system, every living system is connected to the systems within it, around it, and encompassing it. And the same is true of our financial system. So there's no way to address risk management in the financial system without taking a broader view of a holistic living systems context. And that's what the financial system needs to do.
If nothing else, I guess you're risking a revolution and you're risking burning up or consuming your environment, so it's not there in the future. What I always think of in terms of relating the financial system to living systems is that it seems to me that what we have right now is a parasitic system where finance is basically a debt money system, and the money always comes into existence as the debt of a bank at interest, which means more is always owed back than it was issued in the beginning. So there's a growth imperative there. It's exponential growth, and you just don't find exponential growth in nature except for in cancers and parasites, which ultimately consume their hosts and the whole system dies. So to get around that, you need to convert the parasite into some sort of symbiotic relationship. So what do you think? Do you have examples of that sort of thing?
I think one of the most interesting discussions relating to what you've just described, which comes from the natural world, is the design spiral that's been described by evolution biologist Elizabeth Sartoris. So some people may be familiar with this from her presentations and her work, which is a maturation process that living systems go through, where they start competitive. Competition and growth orientation and expansionary focus, those are marks of biological youth, whether you're talking about an organism, like a baby, is focused on growth and expansion of the separated self. Or if you're talking about a species, a young species tends to be more cooperative than an older species. We are a very, very young species on an evolutionary timescale. Or if you're talking about ecosystems, ecosystems also are competitive, characterized by competitive relationship dynamics when they are young ecosystems. So that's a mark of youth. And what we see in nature is a maturation spiral where systems that are in their youthful phase are in competition with each other and oriented around growth and expansion. They eventually learn, they come up against themselves, come up against each other so much that they eventually learn how to cooperate, take a different strategy that in the long run turns out to be the resilient, regenerative strategy. And that's a cooperative strategy. So you could say that we are going through that same learning process. Now, competition and cooperation both play a role in nature. They're both parts of the story. But it is also the case that cooperation is the definitive mark of maturity.
So we could say then that capitalism is a young system. Is that correct? And that some sort of cooperative model would be a more mature system.
If you equate capitalism with competition, then that analogy works in this discussion.
You had also mentioned something about biodiversity. It seems to me that in the banking system today, we're tending toward more homogeneity, like we're getting rid of sovereignty. You can see that particularly in the Eurozone, where countries are having to give up their own central banks and their own financial sovereignty in favor of the ECB and the collective or a single euro system and a single bank that issues their credit backstop. But it seems to me that they're going in the wrong direction, that it would be better to have many little systems that are evolving separately, and that, you know, each one can try out their plan, but so there'd be little systems within a larger system. What do you think about biodiversity as a principle?
Absolutely. That is a very key core principle right now in the discussion of the financial system, I'd say. And the experience of evolution as we best understand it, of course, our understanding is always evolving, but based on our best current understanding, evolution agrees with you that diversity, systemic diversity, is part of the formula for resilience of complex adaptive systems. So even the Bank of England recognized this, or at least it was a researcher from the Bank of England collaborating with a researcher from the University of Oxford who they wrote a paper called Systemic Risk in Banking Ecosystems. And what they did was they drew conclusions looking at ecological design. Specifically, they were studying how viruses spread through networks and the connections of food, the connections within food webs, using those models to draw out principles which suggested that decentralization of risk management strategies would be a good idea in banking regulation. In general, the broader principle that has been identified by groups of biologists that came together to produce a set of design principles called LIFES principles. This was organized by Biomimicry 3.8, and you can Google it. It's in the Creative Commons. Anybody can use these principles. These are design principles that every organism in nature and every natural system at all levels adhere to, for the most part. There may be some very rare exceptions, but these are universal enough that we could think of them as natural design parameters. And in that set of natural design principles, one of them is to embody resilience through decentralization, redundancy, and variation of your design approaches. So in the financial system, that is not what we've got. What we've got is a very, as you said, homogeneous system. We have essentially one species of money that's been planted across the global economy, meaning in terms of what human organisms, what we as human beings actually use in our day-to-day existence to pay our bills, etc. We're using one type of money for the most part around the world, which is central bank-managed, bank-issued debt money, and that's like a monoculture model. So that's like planting one species across a plot of land. That would be the analogy. And it is inherently unstable for the same reason that an agricultural monoculture is unstable, and that a permaculture design for financial architecture has a lot of promise of to be more resilient for the same reasons that a permaculture model is more resilient agriculturally, more sustainable. And that is a model of systemic diversity, where you would have many different species of money planted across the world, different designs of financial systems grown from the bottom up. That's another natural principle. So you can imagine community currencies there might be a diverse range of models of community currencies that are tailored to the context of each local community, that are existing in dynamic non-equilibrium with each other, the same way that ecologies of species exist in dynamic non-equilibrium, and together they achieve resilience that a monoculture can't achieve.
Oh, very interesting. Looking at it from the perspective of public banking, I would think of the German Sparkassen banks, the local public banks in Germany, which are, they're all within the same banking system. Like they're still dealing with debt money, the same euros, etc. But they have a different model of how the money, who owns the money, basically. I mean, who creates the money, who owns the bank, who gets the interest. So you could arguably have a mono or one sort of overarching exchange system or one unit of exchange, perhaps. but many different ways that it comes into existence, or different models, and that would just be sort of competing, maybe that's not a good word, but that would just be sort of growing organically and see which one works out best. I mean, it seems to me that even if you have many different community currency systems, let's say, you might want the people in one little community are going to need to buy stuff that isn't available in their community. So they need access to some sort of some other currency that the big corporations use, let's say, or that the other countries use. So you do need some sort of consistency among currencies. And yet, so you need diversity within unity, something like that. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that suggests the model of systems nested within systems. Then that's the natural world. So the natural world is made up of bodies within bodies within bodies. So homogenized minerals of the earth crust formed bacteria. Those were the first individuals, the first bodies. And they, 2 billion years later, became so cooperative with each other that they together formed the nucleated cell. And those single-celled organisms were the new individuals. Later on, they became so cooperative that they achieved multicellular organisms, which eventually learned how to cooperate in these multipartite mutualisms that form old, stable ecosystems. And they also formed, some of them, formed into collectively evolving communities, which are called superorganisms, and we're one of those. So this spiral of bodies within bodies within bodies, and of course natural systems go all the way up to the global level. We have the world itself is an organism. This is now agreed by the scientific community, no matter which definition of life you choose from the life sciences. It is agreed that the planet itself fits that definition of life. So natural system design moves across every scale up to the planetary level. And it follows a bottom-up spiraling pattern. So we could imagine that same thing occurring with a bottom-up spiraling system design pattern in the financial system, where community currencies learn to communicate with each other and interact with each other and collaborate to the point where they achieve larger systems of exchange, which maybe would be regional systems that then learn to communicate and interact and collaborate with each other eventually to form global systems.
So then how would you go about making a financial system sustainable?
My team at Biomimicry Switzerland, we're taking a two-pronged approach. You can either redirect conventional finance towards biomimicry sectors, biomimetic sectors and technologies. And the reason I would say biomimetic specifically is because that, to my mind, is the most credible definition of sustainability, would be a nature-inspired approach to sustainability. So you can develop an investment framework where you choose your investments based on biological design principles, and that's being done. The first such investment framework was pioneered by Hazel Henderson and Janine Benyus together, both of whom I've already mentioned. Hazel and Janine came up with an idea called Ethical Biomimicry Finance, which is an investment framework based on biological design principles and ethical principles, putting together the work of these two women and their organizations. So that's one approach, is the investment framework approach. I should also mention there's a book by one of my advisors from Biomimicry 3.8. I'm doing a certification program where I'm applying biomimicry to the design of a financial system. One of my advisors on this is a woman named Catherine Collins, who's a vocational investor, who is also a biomimicry specialist, and she's applied biomimicry to the practice of investing in a book called The Nature of Investing. We have a few more initiatives in Switzerland and Liechtenstein, although I'm not quite at liberty to discuss them just yet, because this is the financial sector is a culture of that highly values professional discretion until things are formally launched and formally publicly announced, so I won't try to go into those. But I will say that there are multiple approaches being pursued in the way of developing investment frameworks based on biological design strategies. That's one approach.
So let's say from a practical standpoint, you're an investor. can you count on making as much money on something that is ethical and sustainable as you might on, I mean, in other words, are these investments equally profitable as other investments?
We can say that if you look at case studies of biomimicry projects or products, bio-inspired companies, if you look at those case studies, they do very well in the market. And one reason is that biological design solutions are already pre-screened for efficiency and sustainability of the highest standard, which is the evolutionary standard. So this is 3.8 billion years of experience at designing efficient and sustainable models. So those tend to do well in the market, you could say, for that reason. Formally, this now is being measured by a group here in California at Point Loma Nazarene University, which has developed something called the Da Vinci Global Index, which is tracking the economic potential of the field of biomimicry. And the first iteration of this index is going to be published in January, so you can look forward to that. And the founder of Biomimicry Switzerland is a gentleman named Jacques Chirazi, who's also a trained biomimicry professional. And he is developing some business case studies that will generally help the financial sector understand what these investments look like and how they have come out in the end. And they will that will additionally complement the work of Ethical Markets and Biomimicry 3.8 in developing their investment framework.
Now you're on to your second prong.
Right. So the first prong is the investment methodology. The second pronged approach is to apply biomimicry to financial architecture, so to system design, which is what basically we've been discussing so far. And that's what I've got my head into. So that's the one that I'm primarily focused on myself. So I'm formulating the concept of a biomimicry design challenge for financial architecture called Finance 3.8 for 3.8 billion years of experience at complex adaptive system design. So that's the second approach. The context of this design challenge is it's being taken on by the Global Ecovillages community and the Biomimicry Global Network. So those are our first two real-world contexts for designing and implementing a bio-inspired exchange system.
So what ideas do you have for such a community currency system?
Well, the most interesting thing about this design process is that finance is inherently collective. There's no such thing as a financial system implemented by one person. It takes an entire community to agree to accept a form of money in payment of goods and services in order to even have one. So I myself, as an individual, cannot answer that question, and that's part of what makes this such a fascinating discussion, is that the financial, any money system, new money system that's going to work, the first thing it requires is backing by a community. So this, in both cases, this is going to be a community design process and a collective learning process. And the model that works for each community will be specific to their context.
I like the community currency model because it gets down to basics. It shows that what money really is just credit and debt, or my IOU to you. So this is just a simple system of exchanging credits. I think I read somewhere that credit came from credo, which was to believe. So you need a bunch of people who believe or trust that these little credits will be good in the future, and that's what a credit system is.
I haven't done justice to this discussion but money being a human construct, that actually doesn't in itself qualify it as not being natural, because we are nature, and money is something we've created with our big brains, our human brains, and those are also biological constructs. So actually there is finance in nature, so long as you remember that we are nature. And the second thing I'd like to add to what we've already discussed is that the discussion of financial permaculture has really been pioneered by Bernard Leiter, who I know your audience is probably familiar with as well. He wrote The Future of Money. He was a central banker who is now sort of an intellectual hero of the community currency movement, and he, in his book Money and Sustainability, The Missing Link, with some co-authors, including my colleague Christian Arnsberger, who's also teaching this approach to money system design now in Lausanne, they pioneered this discussion partly in a book called Money and Sustainability, published by the Club of Rome. And it's also recently been backed by the New Economics Foundation, the discussion of a permaculture approach to money system design. So I'd just like to credit them for that.
I think Bernard also wrote a book with Gwen Hallsmith, who is our Executive Director of Public Banking Institute.
Exactly.
You had mentioned earlier when we were talking privately about that the current system is not sustainable because it's gotten away from reality into virtual reality, in other words, derivatives. Do you want to explain that a bit?
Well, looking at the growth of this model, debt-based money, it started in the northwestern triangle of Europe, the Netherlands and England, the Bank of England. It's spread around the globe, and its design is based on the demand for growth, for expansionary growth, at an exponential rate. And that is what helped to drive it to encompass the globe. So it helped us become a global culture in that sense, which is useful for forming a collective consciousness as one humanity. But now it's run out of space in the real world, which to me, I equate the real world with the natural world, so I don't see a usefulness for distinguishing the real economy from the natural world, per se. I don't think that's a useful distinction. So in the real world, being the natural world, there's nowhere left for this to expand at the rate that it wishes to expand. So it's lost interest, literally, in the real world, and is more interested now in the only realm where it can expand exponentially forever, which is virtual reality. And that's evidenced by the fact that we now have a derivatives trade that's valued anywhere between 10 to 20 times the global GDP.
Excellent insight. I tend to think that the current banking model is not all that bad, that it just needs to be transmuted, not gotten rid of altogether, in the sense that, like you say, we needed credit to expand. I mean, credit was an important feature in the development of British civilization and American civilization. And to me, the only problem with it is that, or the major problem with it is that it's a privately owned system. So that's where it tends toward the parasitic, where you've got a private elite that's sucking the profits out. But if you were to return the profits to the system, I think it would be sustainable. Do you have any more examples, for example, from nature or any other comments you want to make? I know you mentioned something about the fungi, and I had read somewhere that mitochondria originally were parasites, and that they learn to become symbiotic with the cell. And so that's the kind of model we want to aim for, where we transmute a parasitic system into a symbiotic system. That's what I would think. Go ahead.
Yeah, my intention is to explore how we can make finance an organ of ecology, which is kind of conjures up the same imagery. So that how can we make our financial system support the health of the body? And that's the function of an organ. That's what an organ does. So some of the models that have been most inspirational, I'd say, at least for me in this discussion, and for many others, are looking at, for example, the forest economy. How resources are exchanged in a forest context. And there's a very important role played in that context by mycelial fungi. The whole kingdom of fungi, fungus, mushrooms, that whole kingdom is much older than either plants or animals as a kingdom. And my mycorrhizal fungus is a superorganism community, just like us. They collectively evolve, and they're supreme cooperators. So mycorrhizal networks under the ground are shifting resources around to where they are needed. Resources, signals, water, sugars, nutrients. So that's a very sustainable model, is when you learn to focus on supporting the broader system around you, that at least for mycorrhizal fungi, that has allowed them to thrive for 2 billion years so far and counting. So that's a pretty good model. And if you look at patterns of how resources move through the forest, what you see is that large established trees are photosynthesizing sugars from the air and sending that resource down to saplings that are less advantaged, that are less established in this economy. The resources are being fixed by the tree, larger trees, and sent down to where there's a greater need. And that's also an interesting dynamic to look at, and it's also very inspiring when we imagine that in our system, resources are flowing the other way, from the have-nots to the haves. And in a forest, that wouldn't be the case. Something else in terms of your public versus private banking discussion that can relate to that forest economy model is that the mycorrhizal networks are acting like public infrastructure, shifting around
in
the resources.
In what way?
Well, they're shifting around resources to where they're most needed. They're they're a communication system and an exchange system for the whole community. And what's neat about it is they're invisible. This is not Big Brother. This is under the ground. They're pretty humble.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned before about how bees and
termites,
yeah, that they don't compete, that they all cooperate, and it's obviously a very bioadaptive, sustainable system.
Well, what you're talking about are superorganisms: bees, termites, social insects, and primates. Superorganisms evolve in community. We are a superorganism. If you were to drop an individual human being in a desert or a forest, the individual wouldn't last too long unless they had some hardcore survivalist training. But in a group, so we're pretty weak as individuals, our survival potential, our fitness. But as a group, we are highly adaptable, just like fire ants. We go everywhere. You can find ants everywhere and you can find humans everywhere. We've taken over the world. And there's a colleague of ours, also on our Biomimicry Switzerland team. Her name is Tamsin Woolley Barker. She's based in San Diego. She's writing a book called Super Organizations, which is how we can apply the lessons of superorganism collaboration, those strategies that have been so successful for groups like us, for humans, and bees and termites, how we can apply those strategies to our organizations to make them just as adaptable and cooperative and successful.
Yeah, I think that's where we're heading, is toward one organism. The earth is one organism with people as cells in the organism, and that the internet and other electronic things like TV have contributed to the ability for us all to communicate as one eventually, hopefully.
Yeah.
Well, it's been really great being able to interview you, Jamie.
It's been great to be on your show.
Thanks. So we've been talking to Jamie Brown Hansen, who is currently a managing partner of Biomimicry Switzerland.
On today's Public Banking Report, we'll be talking with the Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute about some new courses that are being launched this week that will be giving participants a solid grounding in the basics of the new economy and the essential knowledge about money and banking that so many really don't have, even though it underlies all the primary concerns of personal and community life. But first, in public banking news, there are more new municipal and state-level markets opening up for the creation of new public banks, with news that Arizona, Texas, and Massachusetts all have signs of serious political interest. Also in the coming week, the Public Banking Institute is going to be presenting to civic leaders from Seattle, Tacoma, and Spokane, Washington, elected officials from the state of New York, and the newly elected state representatives in Pennsylvania are being scheduled for briefings in January. The reasons are obvious. The financial loads that confront governmental administrations are growing exponentially as tax revenues drop from unemployment, foreclosed homes, and slow business, along with the pressing needs of getting more money to invest in public infrastructure. The situation was bad already, and it's only getting worse with the passage of time and higher financing costs. Which leads us to our guest, Gwen Hall-Smith, the Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute, who has been instrumental in helping develop this new educational resource called the New Economy Academy, which helps fill the knowledge gap of how we've gotten into this untenable economic predicament and how we can get out.
When we all attended the conference in New York about rethinking economics, it became clearer than ever how bereft the current economics curriculum is from some of the issues that we need to understand really well today. Unfortunately, the discipline of economics is stuck sometime back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where they imagine themselves as a science and yet don't pay any attention to the empirical evidence demonstrating that their economic theories don't work. Nonetheless, it hasn't changed, and it's very difficult to change within academia. So we're trying to offer alternative views of how the economy works that are more empirically based through the New Economy Academy. And we're inviting people that want to join the conversation to become members of PBI, to take our courses and to offer courses. If you're out there as a heterodox economist and have been frustrated by the fact that you are not able to offer the kind of curriculum that is really important to address current day problems, let us know, because we're open for business. It's really exciting. Of course, a lot of the early courses that we're offering are about money and banking, because money and banking are actually two of the topics that are virtually off the table in typical economics classes. Nobody ever questions the role of privately owned central banks in economics departments, and nobody does a really good job of analyzing the impact that the money that is generated by privately owned central banks have on the economy.
I was reminded of the reality of what you're describing as being an unconsciousness about how money and banking works. I recently met a gentleman who was a professor at a very well-known university who was teaching economics and finance and banking, but had never heard of a public bank.
Right, I wish it was as simple and innocent as being unconscious. That would be easier to fix. You just bring it to consciousness. However, there is a studied and intentional ignorance about it, and that isn't an accident, because, of course, the big privately owned central banks support a lot of economists and actively discourage people from questioning the basis of their ownership and their money-issuing capacity. Yet it is the most powerful part of the economy. The Federal Reserve in our country invents money out of air, out of thin air, and they charge the rest of us for the privilege of using it. That has made us an indebted nation, basically working very, very hard just to pay back the debts that these private banks are able to generate out of nothing. It's a great business model if you can get it. I wish I could make something out of nothing and charge everybody in the country for using it. But that it's also served as a massive consolidation of wealth and power as well in our country.
And it's clearly, it's not just a domestic issue. This is a global reality. And when you see the development about the G20 ratifying or codifying the bailing in, the confiscation of deposits and now pension,
I know. It's just such an outrage. It is an outrage. They are behaving as if all of the wealth in the world belongs to them instead of to the people that work for it. It really is a fundamental question, and it comes from a long heritage of people in power controlling the economy. There's no question about that. But we are needing to advance beyond those antiquated ideas, because right now those antiquated ideas are impoverishing humanity and destroying the planet. And we need to stop that if we hope to continue as a human species. It's that simple.
So you're basically positioning this New Economy Academy that the Institute is offering as kind of a primer, but also a platform so that people can make sense of what's going on and learn the particulars of what they need to know to help move things forward.
As well as a place to explore the new ideas. You know, the world is full of the ideas about how to do the economy differently, and yet the moribund and very conservative economics departments in most of the universities around the country have not even considered them, much less embracing them. And so it's important to foster dialogue among intelligent people who are willing to look at new ideas about how to run our economy so that everybody benefits and so that we live within the limits of our ecological systems.
There's a course coming up very soon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, two classes this week, actually. One's a class in Boston about the leadership skills and organizing principles needed to move a public banking movement forward. Then on Friday, we have a class that has more subscribed to it than any class we've offered yet on doing an economic impact analysis and feasibility study of a public bank for your region, city, or state. That's an exciting class. It's this Friday at noon, and it's available to members of PBI at no charge.
Great. So in order to sign up and find out more about the classes, people need to go to the...
The PBI website, publicbankinginstitute.org. Look under the New Economy Academy or look under Donate and Become a Member, because the classes
right.
are available to our members.
And what are some of the other courses that are on deck for 2015?
Well, Michael Schumann and I are going to be doing a cutting-edge conversation on getting money to Main Street. We're also doing a class on the power of public banking with Tom Seguros. Michael Schumann and I are working on a book right now on how to take advantage of the new SEC regulations that are coming out about crowd-financed investment. We'll be writing a workbook on that for people, and that's one of the ways that Michael has identified to get more money invested in Main Street businesses to get it out of Wall Street's hands. There's other courses in development right now, including one on community economic resilience. Obviously, the question of banking and money play an important role in our local economies, and there are some proven ways that people can use complementary currencies and other forms of financial management to make their communities more resilient. So that's another class that will be offered over the next year. And as I said, we are inviting people to participate by writing to us and offering courses themselves. Another class we're offering is how to read and understand a consolidated annual financial report of your local government or your state government so that you can start to see what the possibilities are based on the capital that they already have in their control.
In other words, a way for people to find out how much money their community really has at its disposal and or invested in its name.
So. Yes, I believe the public deposits that are out there for all the reserve funds, the rainy day funds, the pension funds, the equipment replacement funds, the capital funds are the great hidden secret of our U.S. banking system, because, of course, all of these public deposits really provide the basis for all of the speculation and trading and high-frequency nonsense that is going on in the banking sector right now. It's also the type of funds that are at most risk in the event of some type of bank collapse again, for exactly the reasons you talked about earlier. The new rules that have come out now from the G20 and from the Bank of International Settlements that put the derivatives holders and repurchase agreement holders in front of the line ahead of depositors.
It's really a stunning prioritization, such an obvious power play and self-serving decision. Gwen, can you set us up for what 2015 looks like for the Public Banking Institute? What are some of your objectives in the next year?
Well, we have an exciting year coming up in 2015. We're working on developing a nonpartisan alliance of elected officials from all over the country who are interested in public banking from all the different parties. I've started developing the work on this with people that range from Tea Party activists to Occupy Wall Street activists and everybody in between. There's a lot of consensus building about the need to change our financial system, and we're hoping to pull it all together in a conference in New Hampshire late in the year next year, probably early November, early December, where we're tentatively calling it Bretton Woods 2.0. It'll be the People's Monetary Congress, and we're planning to come out of that with a statement for all of the political candidates that will be running in the primary race in New Hampshire about how they need to look at the monetary system and the banking system as they take office.
And, of course, there will be a variety of markets that are opening up with public banking, too. So
oh, my goodness, yes, it roll in every day. You know, yesterday we hear that Arizona is introducing legislation, and there's a really excited group about it down in Texas, and I'm going to Seattle next week, and Santa Fe's thinking about a public bank, and New Hampshire is ready to file legislation, and And a newly elected treasurer in Massachusetts thinks that public banks and infrastructure banks are a good way to go to try and invest in housing and roads in Massachusetts. Boy, do we need help making sure we keep up with all the demands, because with very few staff and not a lot of resources, we're struggling, but we are working hard, and I think the New Economy Academy and the other initiatives of the Institute will help propel a movement forward that will fundamentally change the way the economy is working and make it more to the benefit of the people and the world that we live in than it is right now.
That was Gwen Hall-Smith, the Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. Again, if you have an interest in participating in the New Economy Academy courses, which will be starting at the end of this week, go to the Public Banking Institute website at publicbankinginstitute.org and click on the New Economy Academy. Become a member, and the courses are part of your membership. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness, and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.